intestinal diseases and they can't get oral rehydration tablets, like a little pill. Do they think somebody would set that up for them to see? And why wouldn't they believe us? And we said we've been to Nasiriya, to Karbala, to Amaria, to Basra, to Mosul. We've seen this again and again and again. And then one of them said to me, well, you know what I'd really like? And I thought, oh, okay, he's got another angle. But he said, my son is a coin collector, and I hear they've got some real numismatics finds. And I just wonder if you know where I could find some people who collect coins around here. And I thought, oh, you know, he cares so much about his little son who is far away, but wants to bring a smile to his little son's face. Could he not imagine, you know, empathize a little bit with a parent caring about their child and the child can't get an oral rehydration tablet and survive diarrhea?
Mm. Well, finally, Kathy, and this is a concern that I have, and I have been feeling this pressure. There is a strong feeling that impeachment is at the heart of the matter, and that Adam Schiff, who we know is a Cold Warrior, number one recipient of military contributions, is sort of turned impeachment into a Cold War operation. So we're back into sort of a nuclear arms race with the help of Donald Trump. There was a couple of senators, a congressman talked about a limiting Trump. Do you know if the impeachment people are in support of the War Powers Act? Is Adam Schiff, who has was pro-war 2003 for the war, you know, are you concerned that there's a diversion? I want to hold Trump accountable, but this has turned into a Cold War operation?
Well, and, you know, if we want to talk about the impeachable offenses that were most egregious, it really isn't related to Russia having meddled in our elections. I think the most egregious offenses have to do with the re-entry into an escalating nuclear arms race through deciding to pour tons of money into re-outfitting the nuclear weapons that are already in existence, rather than trying to, like, follow the lead of the United Nations that put forth the international treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. The attack against General Qasem Soleimani that assassinated him, the development of drone attacks in general everywhere where they're being used, the, you know, ratcheting up of economic sanctions against Iran, the threats made against Iraq, all of these things, along with failure to deal with climate catastrophe, failure to deal with mass incarceration, to effectively deal with our immigration concerns when children are in cages at the border, all of these things that we can trace to President Trump and his failed administration. You know, I don't see any of the nominees for the Democratic presidential nomination, or any of the candidates, I'm sorry, taking on with enough vigor the military-industrial congressional media Washington, D.C. complex. Certainly Bernie Sanders has taken the most risk. I know a fellow with Vets for Peace who, out of sheer frustration, said, my neutered hamster has more courage than all 13 of them combined. But I do see that maybe in the debate tomorrow night, concerns for the Poor People's Campaign and concerns about unbridled militarism might come up. I certainly hope so, and I certainly hope it would give a candidate like Bernie Sanders a chance to distinguish himself.
All right, Kathy. Well, we appreciate you taking the time out. If people want to find out more about Voices for Creative Nonviolence or about the trip that some of you made to Iran, people to people, or all the incredible work you've been doing in Afghanistan, in Iraq, people to people, what's the best way?
Well, we have a website, vcnv.org. That's the acronym for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And if anybody wanted to email Voices, just info@vcnv.org, and we can send that MailChimp email letter that we send about two or three times a month, and people could also get onto our postal mailing list, and people are welcome to email me at Kathy@vcnv.org, and we'll go anytime, any place, with or without a stipend, though we do need help with transportation. If people have a venue, whether it's a high school or a college or a living room or a church group, this is the kind of thing we do. We really do believe in education, but education leading to activism. And of course, activism should always educate us.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there, but we thank you again, Kathy. Please.
Thank you, Dennis. Well, thank All you good so wishes much. To you.
Same to you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the Magical Music Petting Zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It is 6 minutes after 11. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Cool Solutions. In this episode, Climate Emergency Declarations Wake People Up and Bring Them Together. Local residents from Gainesville, Florida and Hoboken, New Jersey tell how they went from anxiety to action. Followed by Althea and Tammy, who will be talking about KBOO's 2020 vision for the elections, programs, and more. Here is Cool Solutions.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis.
And you are listening to Cool Solutions, climate action from the bottom up.
Emergency, emergency.
Thanks to the voices of young activists like these, the way we talk about climate change is changing. In 2018, the words most commonly paired with emergency were health, hospital, and family. In 2019, it's climate. When it comes to emergencies, the global has eclipsed the personal. We're hearing the same phrase on the lips of scientists.
11,000 scientists from around the world recently signed a manifesto stating that clearly and unequivocally, the planet Earth is facing a climate emergency.
It's not too late to stabilize global temperatures at a less than completely catastrophic level, but we have to act fast.
And yet, most of the world is still operating as if it was business as usual. Despite the change in vocabulary, we're not putting our money where our mouth is.
Only 6 of the world's top 20 economies are on track to meet their Paris commitments. And even if they all kept their promises, we'd still be on track for global heating to reach civilization-wrecking levels as early as 2050.
What's the matter with us?
Chalk it up to obsolete wiring. Our brains evolved when we were living in caves. They don't sound the alarm for threats that approach more slowly than a saber-toothed tiger. And we have a big blind spot, denial of our own mortality. We don't act as if our lives are in danger until the tiger, wildfire, or tornado is right in front of us. This was an evolutionary advantage back when risk-taking helped propagate the species, but now it's leading us in the opposite direction. And then there's this. Remember your mom saying, just because Johnny jumps off a cliff.
Does that mean you're going to jump off a cliff too?
Sorry, Mom. We're all jumping. Rebecca Harris is an organizer for the Climate Mobilization,
a national group trying to raise the perceived threat of climate change to DEFCON 1 and galvanize a World War II scale response.
The group was founded by clinical psychologist Margaret Klein Salomon, who spent a lot of time thinking about this human lemming effect. Rebecca explains it like this.
Even if we're in an obviously dangerous situation, if everyone around us is acting like things are normal, then we're just going to ignore those cues as well.
Social psychologists call this pluralistic ignorance, but in their definition, people do know something's wrong. But because others don't act alarmed, they think they're the only ones, so they go along with the crowd. In reality, each person in the crowd is feeling the same way, but since nobody acts as if anything's amiss, everybody stands around doing nothing. So we've got outdated hardware that doesn't flag slow-moving disasters till they're on top of us, and if we do get any inkling, we lack the confidence to take ourselves seriously.
Is this the pull the covers up over your head episode? It's working.
I'm just trying to set the scene and explain what drove Greg Undeen to tackle fossil fuel addiction with a 12-step program.
Greg lives in Gainesville, Florida, where climate change is hard to ignore. The frequency of severe hurricanes there has more than tripled.
We are constantly looking during hurricane season for places to flee to.
The sea level has risen 8 inches since 1950, and the rate is accelerating. Tidal flooding has also tripled.
Even with the most optimistic emissions projections, the state will have to spend $76 billion by 2040 building 9,000 miles of seawalls just to protect public infrastructure. That's nearly as much as the entire state budget.
Hundreds of thousands of homes are also at risk. Because of his work with the Alachua Coalition for the Homeless and Hungry, Greg understands the difficulty of housing all those displaced people.
Where we are in north central Florida, we happen to be over 100 feet above sea level, and so we are anticipating receiving a lot of refugees. We are talking about preparing for 9 million people that live 4 feet above sea level in South Florida that are going to be undoubtedly migrating to North Florida. And so our crisis is, how do we handle that?
Still, pointing out the increasingly obvious doesn't make one popular.
I've been following climate change for the last decade and had been announcing everything that I was reading and learning about this crisis and sharing it on Facebook, essentially. My friends would say that I looked like some guy in the corner with a sandwich board saying the sky is falling.
I'm sorry, my friends. I didn't want to stop you when you were having such a fine time. But this is an emergency. Your house is all on fire. And if we do not rise up now, all this will turn to ashes. I'm sorry, my friend. I didn't want to trouble you when you were having such a hard time. But this is an emergency. The waters are all climbing, and so we have to rise up now, or we will soon be drowning.
And I was discouraged from doing this. I was being ostracized by my friends and family.
Not by nature a protester. He spent 10 years fretting over this.
Worrying about it, wondering what it was I could do about it. And I had just reached a point where I was personally feeling like I had to work a step on it. I'm a member of a 12-step fellowship, so I started applying the steps to climate change because it was such a pressing issue for me. And when climate mobilization came around, what they were saying was right in line with what I believe, which is that mitigation is unmanageable from a personal consumer level, and that I needed to turn this over to a power greater than myself, and that power greater than myself happens to be my local government. This just clicked for me. I'm not religious at all, but it felt like a God thing. So I guess that's really where I began.
Thank you.
hooked up with the Climate Mobilization's campaign to get local governments to declare a climate emergency. The idea is that these public declarations can shatter the silence that feeds pluralistic ignorance and get people talking and working together. Rebecca Harris is the campaign's main organizer.
She was moved to become a climate activist when she considered becoming a parent.
It just became very tangible to me for the first time what type of world is even going to be around for this potential child to grow up in. We believe that we need an ambitious whole society, whole government mobilization away from fossil fuels at emergency speed.
And when upper levels of government aren't moving fast enough, you start organizing from the bottom up. For Greg, the goal was to get the Gainesville City Commission to declare a climate emergency and develop a plan to transition off fossil fuels. You might think there's nothing to be done until the climate denier-in-chief leaves the White House, but there's actually a lot local government can do.
Local governments can take action to ban the extraction of fossil fuels and the burning of fossil fuels as well. An example of that is that Berkeley, as well as Brookline, Massachusetts, just banned natural gas hookups in new construction. Local governments, as an organization that convenes people, can spread the message that this is an emergency and activate people around getting involved. In some communities, deliberative democracy holds a lot of promise for getting people to come up with solutions that have the support of residents. Kind of like jury duty, giving people space and time and paid time off to recommend how local government can respond. Another important piece is anything that comes down nationally is going to have to be implemented by the local government. We don't want to pass a Green New Deal or pass a climate emergency program and then have it basically just not be implemented. So we think that's a big reason why organizing at the local level is important. And we're also mobilizing to build power, right? Because we know that none of this is going to happen unless we get millions of people involved.
Greg's first step was to attend one of the Climate Mobilization's two-day organizing workshops. He found that just being with other people concerned about climate was a big relief.
You know, I wasn't able to connect with anybody. I didn't have a support group. And when I went up to Boston for training with Climate Mobilization, it was the first time that I'd been in a room full of people who all were on the same page with climate change. And I can't tell you what a relief that was, that we didn't even have to talk about any of those issues anymore. There was nothing that needed to be explained away. We all were on the same page. We all understood the crisis. And it was a cathartic experience to just be surrounded by people who knew what we were facing.
While Northern Florida is generally politically conservative, the Gainesville area, with its state university, is a blue island in a sea of red. And city government there has already been working to lower its carbon footprint.
We really don't have the ability to go much further than what we've already done. We've already bought the most fuel-efficient vehicles we can afford. The city already has electric vehicles. They're switching to electric buses. We've changed all our light bulbs that we can to LEDs, but we still are seeing an increase in CO2. And this climate emergency is really to send a signal to Washington and to our state legislators saying that, look, you guys can do something about this. You can set limits to what we are doing. I really felt motivated coming back from that training. It put me in an emergency mode. Started reaching out to the people I knew and started feeling my way through the community. And what I was taught in climate mobilization was to form coalitions. We need to reach out to other activists and make a connection. And in that, they taught us to listen more than anything. We were supposed to do like 20% of the talking and 80% listening to your coalition friends. I went to an activist that I'd known for years, and he had an issue surrounding a bill of rights for a body of water. We in North Florida have the largest producing aquifer in the world. It all just flows up to the surface of the ground, and we have springs, 75 of them, along 75 miles of river. So I joined this guy in his petitioning to basically change the county charter to endow this river with a bill of rights so it can protect itself. So I was out in the streets working for him.
While he was out getting petitions signed for the river, he was also recruiting allies to meet with city commissioners about the climate emergency.
Looked for, especially young people, so the commissioner wouldn't be staring in the face these eyes of children who were going to be facing this crisis in the future. They would be living it. But it really wasn't needed. Once I started interacting in a community where I was amongst decision makers, I found quite a few more people that were engaged in climate debate in their own head, how we would address a crisis. The momentum that has started from this climate strike, the school strike, has really just put it in the mind of everyone. I felt like I was the one coming in on the tailwind of something that was already going.
The first commissioner they met with was eager to help.
You know, she was more than friendly. She was like, let's work on this together. She basically took the pulse of the city commission for me and showed me the way.
Here's the proposal coming before the city commission, introduced by City Commissioner Helen Warren.
The request that I have is to be able to make a statement that we are in a climate emergency. And that's not to create chaos or put us in a state of panic, but similarly to how we deal when the weatherman tells us there's a hurricane coming. There's a way to be prepared. And there's a way to act that is different than what I have found myself doing when I hear conversations about climate change and what one country is doing or what they aren't doing. You know, I've kind of just had it in the back of my head that somebody else is going to have to take care of this. The idea of this proclamation is to join voices with more than 11,000 other communities across the globe that we are in an emergency position, to carry that message to Tallahassee and to Washington, D.C.
My name is Nkwanda Ja. I want to thank Commissioner Warren in stepping up to the plate to sound the alarm of the climate emergency. I chair the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Committee. We are 20 organizations strong. We all know that it's always our most vulnerable citizens who suffer the greatest in a crisis. Dealing with this emergency now gives us an opportunity to make sure we prepare for all.
My name is Jay Rosenbeck. I come before you today on behalf of the 535 members of the League of Women Voters of Alachua County to speak in support of this proposed proclamation.
My name is Ariana Colon Sherman, and I'm in my first year at University of Florida. I can say from a youth's perspective that being the first city in Florida to be having this conversation is something that means a lot to us, and I hope that this conversation doesn't stop here. I hope that we'll all be here ready to listen and our hands ready to work.
Greg had expected at least some initial hesitation and need for education.
But the whole process from Greg's orientation to the city commission's declaration only took 6 weeks.
They were willing to adopt it right then and there. So that was the biggest shock. I was in tears. It was just awe-inspiring to hear them latch onto this document and go, wow, this is it. This is what we need to do. We know what we need to do.
In addition to declaring a climate emergency and urging the state and federal government to do the same, the proclamation establishes a task force to develop a 10-year mobilization plan.
We asked Greg how he feels now.
I've gone through a mix of feelings, a mixed bag for sure. In one respect, it solidifies the issue, kind of makes it more real. There's levels of denial that I've recognized in myself, but the ability to talk about it and to share about it and not be afraid to talk about it, the new friends that I've made and the support group that I've gained from this action is a lifesaver. You know, I want to be an activist. I want to carry this on to the county level and then on to neighboring cities, or at least teach others how to do the same thing. You know, this was a real easy win for us here, but I don't know how easy it'll be the next time. I want to learn from this experience.
When this interview was recorded, Gainesville was the most recent city in the U.S. to declare a climate emergency. The following week, the city of Minneapolis and the European Union passed climate emergency resolutions. Over 500 cities have passed resolutions in the last 6 months. But as we all know, in politics, words are cheap.
It's another thing to put your money where your mouth is. So is declaring an emergency just a symbolic gesture?
To find out, we talked with Mike Watson from Hoboken, New Jersey, the third city in the world and the first in the U.S. to declare a climate emergency back in 2017.
Climate emergency groups like the Climate Mobilization, Extinction Rebellion, and Sunrise Movement say it's important to be completely honest and not sugarcoat the truth to avoid scaring people.
Because the truth, the reality, is terrifying. Mike describes his first encounter with climate truth.
I always knew that there was a problem and that we had to address it and that we needed renewables. I guess it just seemed like things were under control, things were trending in the right direction. And I saw some kind of infographic that showed how steeply we would have to curb emissions by what dates if we wanted to prevent ecological collapse, you know, mass chaos. And it was devastating. You can't bargain with these physics. This is just the cold reality of what has to happen or what will happen if we don't.
Rebecca says devastation is not an uncommon reaction.
We absolutely see folks being very emotionally impacted. People cry. There's a lot of people really struggling with the burden of understanding the risks that we face. We support people in channeling that into action and into meaning.
I realized that it wasn't enough to just be like, climate change is real.
Of all the groups he could have joined, he picked the climate mobilization.
They were the only ones that seemed to have a solution at the scale of the problem. It wasn't like a carbon tax or something, you know, like, oh, we'll just change our light bulbs. It was like, no, we have to transform the whole of our society to something similar to what we did during World War II. Otherwise, we're just not going to meet this problem and we're going to fail. I was doing the whole, oh, I'm afraid to lead. I'm just going to support something that already exists.
But eventually he worked up the courage to start a Hoboken chapter and convinced his friends and fiancé to become charter members.
And because we had four people, we had enough to form a board and do an election for chapter president, and I was elected. But first, we kind of were just doing a lot of trainings, a combination of the science of climate change and theory of change, nonviolent movements, and this idea of withdrawing consent from institutions that are leading us towards our doom. I knew how bad things were and could be, and you know, my other board members trusted things were bad enough, but I guess I kind of had like wanted to like withhold the degree to how bad things were. My fiance and it's my, you know, one of my good friends, I had this like desire not to scare them as deeply as I myself was scared, which is antithetical to what TCM is about. In the early days, I wasn't quite doing it right. And so when we did these trainings, they laid the data out pretty matter-of-factly. And so at that moment, we're on the same page. It wasn't just like, oh, we're trying to do good things in the community. It was like, actually, it's just straight up a fight for survival.
Like Greg, Mike also found solace in numbers.
Seeing that you're not the only people who are afraid, you see 20 people with you, and that's really valuable to see that you're not alone.
It wasn't just fear of climate change that Mike and his friends had to overcome.
We spent half a year just psyching ourselves up to have our first public meeting, and we should have just had our first public meeting. We've been doing this 4 years now, and of course, there are plenty of times where, like, I'll get stumped, or I'll say something stupid, or the PowerPoint won't work, and we'll be like, oh my God, they look like idiots. But the fact is that people still keep coming anyway, and people understand that we're all human, and that if you have a typo in your presentation, it doesn't mean your point is wrong. And the kind of person that would argue that isn't really arguing in good faith anyway.
When climate deniers showed up at their monthly meetings, they didn't spend time trying to convince them.
Polls clearly show that a majority of Americans want our government to take climate action.
If a person's a climate denier or a climate delayer, the amount of energy that you're going to spend trying to get them to agree to something as radical as a mobilization or a Green New Deal or even just a carbon tax, which is not radical at all, but to some people it seems to be, that's just so much effort and it's just not a good use of your time. There are so many people who are scared and who already agree with you and don't have a direction or a group that they can do something about it with. And your job is to go find those people and to build something with them.
So that's what Mike and his friends did in Hoboken, growing their chapter from the founding four to over 50 active members. They brought their emergency resolution to the city's green team and got their support.
The green team is made up of one city council person, the city's sustainability officer, and a group of citizens appointed by the mayor.
This is where it gets interesting. The plan was for the council person on the green team to bring the resolution to the full city council. But month after month, it kept getting bumped off the agenda.
However, this was an election year. There was one Republican running for mayor. At the time, she was a city council president. And she was accused by one of the other candidates of not even believing in climate change. And so this resolution that we had submitted that kept getting like bumped from meeting to meeting because I just didn't have time for it or whatever. The next day, top of the pile, boom, signed and passed.
Unanimously.
So looking back 2 years later, what did it accomplish?
We did get some immediate victories out of it in that municipal buildings are very quickly decarbonizing. all the municipal things that you could kind of very quickly switch to, Hoboken is doing.
It wasn't a silver bullet. While Hoboken's resolution committed to eliminating greenhouse gas emissions entirely by 2030, the resulting climate action plan only lowered them by 1% per year. Yeah, ouch.
You can't pass it and then expect that the city is going to do the right thing. Do not constantly pay attention and banging at their door. There is no shortcut to building a movement. A plan can be a part of that. But if you think that the plan is going to build the movement alone, no one is going to have like this aha moment where they look at your beautiful plan and they go, wow, I'm taking millions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry, but my God, this is just so perfect. This is what's going to save us. That's not how it's going to happen. There's just no magic plan or piece of legislation that is going to get us where we have to be.
The resolution did help to build the movement.
Passing it has allowed us to bring a lot of other people in because people want to feel like someone has a plan. And when you say that you've written and passed a resolution at this level, people start to pay attention to you a bit more and actually feel maybe they're in the right hands when they come try and work with you. And then also because it was a community stakeholder process, we were able to use the city's mass emails to tell people in the community this is happening, if you care about it, to come here. And so because of that, we were able to bring many people together.
And that led to more climate action. Within 2 years, the city had committed to 100% clean electricity by 2030.
There were other benefits.
Writing and passing the resolution gave us clout as an organization that we've used to get our foot in the door with the mayor and city council members.
Climate activist attendance at Green Team meetings also helped the city's sustainability coordinator be more effective.
Us being there gave her an avenue where she could pursue advancing Hoboken's climate agenda because she couldn't just on her own do it as a municipal employee, but because we were there, all of a sudden she could. And then also just the experience of learning how to write and pass legislation has been really important to us because the biggest thing that we're working on right now is trying to pass a statewide moratorium on all new fossil fuel infrastructure. If we had not written and passed a resolution before, we wouldn't necessarily know where to start.
So while the resolution didn't transition Hoboken off fossil fuels overnight, elevating climate change to emergency status did accelerate the process. We asked Mike what he imagines it'll be like to live in a post-carbon Hoboken.
I think about breathing air and it's clean like the air that you breathe in the suburbs, riding electric ferries across the river, perhaps knowing about underwater turbines that might be powering parts of our city, full community solar, electric buses, green jobs, to the point where a lot of people could actually work inside of Hoboken and not have to commute, all the green space that we're going to have, and a lot of bad smells would be gone too, which would be nice.
Mike says Hoboken's climate emergency resolution was worth doing, but now it's time to move on.
As a tool in the toolkit, it's really useful, but you know, a hammer is not for everything, right? I've personally come to the feeling that we have received about as much as we're going to get by asking nicely and having a good plan. We are at a point now as a chapter where it's going to have to come from people power to get what we need to move forward. People throw around the number. If you have 3.5% of the population engaged in the streets, your goals are almost guaranteed to succeed. And in Hoboken, that looks like about 2,000 people, which is not too many.
If you are interested in getting your town to pass a climate emergency resolution, the Climate Mobilization has trainings, monthly phone calls, one-on-one mentoring, educational materials, and sample resolutions and implementation plans. Check them out online at theclimatemobilization.org.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis, and you've been listening to Cool Solutions, Climate Action from the Bottom Up.
Thanks to our guests, Greg Undine, Rebecca Harris, and Mike Watson, and to Josh Woodward, Scott Holmes, Jason Shaw, the XR Choir, and the Spirit Young Performers Company for our music.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Tammy, and I'm the Public Affairs Director, and here with me is Althea Billings, the News Director.
Hello, hello.
How's it going, Althea?
It's going all right.
It's nice to be here with you at the studio again. And today, we are going to talk about some of yesterday's programming and just give a square table discussion about it.
Square table discussion, mm-hmm. Behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes,
bit.
Yeah.
Draw back the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different idioms to use to talk about what our intentions are here today. So yesterday, listeners may know, we devoted our entire day of programming, 8 to 8, to Hindsight 2020, which was a fun pun that we enjoyed, to describe a day devoted to debriefing the last 3 years since the 2016 election. And we wanted to attack that from a variety of different angles.
Yes, and that was the Hindsight 2020, and this is Foresight 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Hindsight on Hindsight. I don't know if we've settled on one.
But I figured for the next half hour, right up to the top of the hour, we can discuss about, talk about some of our favorite pieces and maybe some of the interviews. I know that you did the local politics interviews with the was it the editor?
News editor of the Portland Mercury.
Yeah, yeah. And that was great. What were some of the points that were most enlightening to you in that interview?
I mean, she was a great person to talk to. She pays pretty close attention to City Hall. And thinking about the last 3 years, it's interesting because I think, you know, switching into 2020, everyone's like, what happened in mm-hmm. the last decade? And the last decade, for me at least, is almost like an insurmountable amount of time to really try to understand what's happened. But the last 3 years, looking back on it now, we can kind of see themes that have been happening in local politics. So we got to talking about, obviously, protest culture mm-hmm. and everything that has happened since Trump was elected in Portland, how that plays into policing, changing expectations of police. Obviously, the police union contract negotiations are coming up this year, so it's a very present issue. We talked a bit about homelessness and also changes at City Hall. Obviously, the election of Joanne Hardesty was a major landmark, as well as Chloe Udaly, first renter on the mm-hmm. council. We also got to talking a little bit about the Portland City Commission structure, which is a funky way of doing government, mm-hmm. And how that sort of structure actually has a major impact on how we do business, and no other major city does it that way. And so there's actually likely going to be a ballot initiative to switch that up this year. So that'll also be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah. I know that you had mentioned that specific aspect a while ago. You were looking at the way that all the commissioners are, and you're like, what is going on? This makes no sense. So that's really neat that you got.
Yeah, I've gotten very entangled in that issue recently, because it's wild, in my opinion, that we do things that way. And I think it would be a good thing to see it change structurally. It favors, you know, it doesn't give regional control to different areas. You don't have a particular representative, and it gives a major advantage to candidates who can fund a citywide campaign, mm-hmm. which means it's a lot of white dudes with a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my major takeaways from that conversation, and it kind of plays into other programs we played throughout the day, I was asking Alex Zielinski, the news editor, what she thought about where is Portland headed? What is our trajectory? And she was saying that in the past 3 years, we've seen new and different conversations at City Hall, mm-hmm. more nuanced looks at different issues, and that there's new players in these conversations. And that, you know, our understanding of houselessness in the past 3 years has evolved so much, and that likely we will continue to see those things, mm-hmm. continue to see, you know, understanding issues complexly, coming up with more complex solutions. Yeah.
That's cool. That's great.
Yeah.
And what are some of your... they're all awesome and they're all favorites, but what were some of the other interviews or subject that really kind of stood out to you?
I mean, Totality of Circumstances, which is the show on police and community and those interactions, they did a wonderful job. Claire Rosciotto did a piece on privacy and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely been a big issue the past 3 years. And really, I mean, the whole day having these different issue areas, it's even, you know, helping to produce it,
mm-hmm.
you realize, you know, things that you forget to think about because so much to think mm-hmm. about. What about you? What were some of your faves?
Definitely the way that Totality of Circumstances did kind of, I felt like when I was listening, it took me on a whole trip. You know, mm-hmm. I went back 3 years ago. I felt like I was really there. I felt really connected with the subject matter, and hearing so many different voices of people from the station, which was my favorite thing about it, is that there were so many different voices part of the special programming, and hearing a stage and studio and Art Focus do more of like the, you know, artistic side of it. How has the last few years impacted the artistic community and artists in Portland and around the world? And they're all really fantastic. The vocational education was really interesting. I know that a lot of people were also very interested in it. Yeah, I didn't realize
I got a call of good response. And, yeah, you know, we love getting those calls. Give us a definitely. Call about how much you like our programming. We love to hear it.
Yeah, if you want to join the conversation, you can. 503-231-8187. So shout out to Suzanne LeGrand for doing that interview. And personally, I really loved being able to air my part two interview with Mohamed Al-Jury, who is the person who has been very much affected by the current situation in Yemen because of his family. Some of them are there, some of them are not. It's just the whole story was just fascinating. Seeing how the story develops and the growth in you know, unfortunately his story and just the way that it's been affecting him. It's you know, in the news cycle, especially in, you know, in radio and the news cycle in general, we are exposed to so much, and the news cycle is very short. And just be able to touch base with him again and hear that for him, the news cycle hasn't ended and it's still going on. And for millions of people, it's still going on. And unfortunately, now we are seeing that you know, Iraqis are being attacked and being taken away their legal status, and you know, just people being turned away from the border, and it's just getting worse. So although there's a lot of positivity looking into the future, I really am glad that I was able to amplify that some people the last 3 years have just been getting progressively worse. And it is an international story, but it is affecting someone who is in our community here in Portland. So you know, everyone is living their own fight club, and no one necessarily is talking about it. So I was really humble and honored that he shared his story with me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that follow-up. You know, you talk to so many people in so many different contexts mm-hmm. doing what we do, and getting to check in and follow that story is very cool.
Yeah. And then, of course, after the evening news, there was a censorship story. So that was really interesting by Jenka, who is also here on staff, I think might be joining us, hopefully. That was fascinating because it's censored news stories that, you know, they are censored. So that was cool to hear the development of journalism and the way that fake news, how the label fake news is being used as an attack on legitimate news stories sometimes, and it's not necessarily always actually fake news. And here is the producer of that segment. How's it going, Jenka?
Hey, Jenka. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Hopefully this mic is working.
It is.
You great. Sound great.
Yeah, so we were talking about Censored 2020. There are so many stories in here that we only got to a few of them in the half hour last night. And also I wanted to let people know, just as the website coordinator, that we've got this whole special on our website now. So if you missed any of these shows yesterday, you can go to kbu.fm/Hindsight 2020, and we'll have links to all of the pieces from yesterday, looking back over the last 3 years, the environment, the labor, all of the issues, and that's on the website. And like especially that interview with Mohamed that you were just talking mm-hmm. about, that I think really humanized the situation in Yemen. And especially when he talked about his family and his dad passing away, having to go to Malaysia and meet the rest of his family. The way that these wars separate families is something that we really need to consider and to talk about, especially with all of the beating of the drums for war with Iran. And it's something that the human side of political decisions that KBU, I think, talks about a lot more than any other station.
Yeah, it's and that also going back to the labor interview with grassroots coordinator Marvin of Voss, that was just, you know, that was his big thing where he kept mentioning that he just wants people to realize that these workers, they're just humans too, and they have families as well. So, and it's really big just to keep reminding that. And I was very touched that he, and actually surprised that that was the biggest point that he wanted to make. And I didn't, it's sad to know that they don't get treated like humans.
Yeah, I mean, it's appalling the things that don't get reported in the major media, and things that there's the self-censorship and there's the decisions to cover certain stories and not others. And things like when you talk about the human side of things, like as I read this Project Censored book, Censored 2020, I got to this story, number five, that is about modern slavery. There are 400,000 people living in slavery in the United States alone. And I mean, if this isn't an emergency, the fact that that people are living in slavery, and they talk about people whose passports have been taken, domestic workers, sex workers who are forced into that, and people in prison. You know, our 13th Amendment bans slavery except for those duly convicted of a crime. So that fact is one of the many stories that didn't get major reporting this past couple of years, but it's one mentioned in the Project Censored book. And then the case of Santoya Brown is another one that is related to that, as somebody who's a survivor of sexual abuse and sex slavery, who actually fought back and killed her abuser. And so the very little news coverage of that, it got some national attention, but there are many, many other stories like Santoya Brown's that the mainstream establishment news outlets just don't treat as newsworthy. Like in 2012, Marissa Alexander, convicted in Florida of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, when she used a gun to fire a single warning shot into the air to deter her abusive husband. So many people have these types of stories, fighting back against sex slavery and being then convicted for it and being blamed as people who are engaging in self-defense.
Yeah, and it's, there are so many stories. You know, you have this book here, and it is thick. You know, it's pretty thick. And part of the Hindsight 2020 special programming yesterday was to give an outline, but also to kind of, I guess, foreshadowing what we're going to do for this upcoming year. And we, as a programming team, have decided, Althea and I, to give certain themes to the month, but also to focus things in a way that isn't necessarily, women's rights. Well, that consists of so much, because the type of things that, for example, white American women have to deal with isn't something that, you know, women in Indonesia have to deal with, or even a black woman in the same city. So it's so encompassing, from women's rights to reproductive rights to sex work to women that are enslaved in this country, to the indigenous murdered and missing women. So that's something that I know I want to amplify and not forget and not get stuck in this in the regular news cycle, because it's unfortunate there's, again, this thick book of all these news that we're not reported on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, KABU has reported on a good number of these stories, and I think Mickey brought that out, that it's stations like KABU, it's small community media outlets that are actually doing this type of reporting that other places are not. And it, as he pointed out also, it isn't all negative. I mean, it seems like we're in a major crisis, which we are. The climate crisis is pretty extinction level event, and so people are standing up for that. And he also noted that there are good things that are happening that aren't getting reported on. Mm-hmm. So like how the scientists were using electricity to regrow coral reefs, these type of innovations that were happening this past couple of years that just get lost and not reported on. Another one that was like kind of a more positive advancement, where people take action to actually make things happen and make change, are this one about food systems in schools being more equitable. So it was in 2018, a grassroots alliance of ranchers, fishers, farm workers, students, and environmental advocates called on the nation's three largest food service management companies, that's Aramark, Compass Group, and Sodexo, to shift from exclusive relationships with big food corporations to greater investment in real food that supports producers, communities, and the environment, and local food producers. Here in the Portland Public Schools, there is like on KBOO a few weeks ago, I heard the local tamale company that
the food show
putting in the tamales in the schools all across the city. And so that kind of local food systems and the connections between schools and local farms and communities is something that is happening and that people are taking action on. And it makes a big difference in kids' ability to learn when they actually have good, solid local food that is not junk food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another ongoing theme that I noticed yesterday was the how everyone went back to the youth and how much the youth is doing and how much they are, you know, so ready and, you know, to pass the torch and to move forward with the youth because they feel like they are not going to take it. They're not going to deal with this. And they're, you know, every single person pretty much mentioned how their, you know, kids are walking out of school and protesting and how they are creating and asking for, more inclusive spaces. So that was something that I definitely heard that from, I want to say almost every single person that was interviewed.
Yeah. And just seeing that, you know, I think older folks have a tendency to let kind of that cynicism, that onslaught of all of these bad news stories or following different things that, you know, it can render you to feel powerless, you know, like there's so much going on. How could I even make one lick of difference? And it's very encouraging to see that young people are having the courage to do that and having the courage to stand up and, you know, work on these issues that have, you know, gone for so long without, you know, meaningful change.
Yeah, they're not going to take it. And I don't know where they get this bravery, you know. So good for them. This shout out to all of the youth, the young folks that are making things happen.
And I mean, I think everyone has something to learn from that.
Oh yeah, you know? Definitely. Yeah.
You can always do something.
Mm-hmm.
And doing something is better than doing nothing.
That's true. And it another ongoing theme is the sense of community, how all of these things can make you feel crippled, all of these bad news and negativity, but reaching out to your community is the first step in having, you know, that companionship, that camaraderie, and that just feel of, you know, there's power in numbers. And from the labor center to the education to, you know, people banding together against police brutality, all, you know, even in the local politics, you know, there are people that go to City Hall and they oppose all of these things, or they're like, this commissioner, you know, the way that this is working out is not good. We want to change it. So banding together and giving yourself a sense of community, it's so empowering, you know, and without, you can't do this alone. We can't be walking here in these streets alone. We've got to band together.
Right. From, you know, you've got the grassroots support on so many different issues now. And that's one thing that I don't know that we highlighted specifically, but since the 2016 election, nonprofits and grassroots organizations have gotten some more people in their ranks, gotten some more people to be involved with them, because that sense of urgency has kind of resurfaced.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in Asia's piece, she talked about how she got involved in KBOO because Trump got elected, you know, and that impetus of that election and people getting out in the streets and getting organized and taking action has led to more involvement in community media and in grassroots organizing.
Yeah, and shout out to Asia. You know, Asia did that live. That was a live piece, so shout out to her.
The immigration hour was awesome, Ayla, if you're listening.
And if you missed some of the programming yesterday, you can go online, kboo.fm/hindsight2020. That's one word, right, Jacob?
Yep, hindsight2020, and you'll find the audio there from the different segments. One of the stories in Project Censored about immigration is this idea of the Central American caravan that was a big media kind of focus and meta narrative in 2018, when that imagery was a created imagery, and it was a created imagery in order to demonize people from Central America who are fleeing violence, who are fleeing wars, who are fleeing the U.S. Overthrow of democratically elected governments. Like in Honduras, to flee that violence and to actually find a safe place. I mean, there are refugees, and to say that this is a caravan, it implies a different sort of travel, and
It would give like a whimsical kind of feel, you know, like, oh, yeah.
Well, language just, matters.
Yeah, language matters 100%.
How we describe things, how we characterize things, you know, there's so much layered within that, so many implications of, you know, who deserves to be treated what way.
And it connotes the historic connotation is a gypsy caravan, which is a derogatory term to begin with of the Roma people. But then this connotation of an itinerant traveling group, as opposed to looking at the chaotic conditions that are pushing people to flee in such desperation for their lives, and just trying to find a safe place where they can actually live.
Right, and malice does not play into it in any way, despite, you know, kind of what the narrative around that had been.
Yeah.
This idea that I think the current regime in the White House has pushed in the narrative from the start, just saying that Mexico is not sending their best. They're sending rapists and criminals with absolutely no evidence, because the evidence shows that immigrants have a lower rate of crime in the U.S. than people who are born here, just statistically.
There's also lots of studies that say having immigrants in communities is great for bringing down the crime rate.
And there's some of the highest rates of entrepreneurship of people starting businesses are people who have who are first generation immigrants. But the narrative and the way that the major media spins it is problematic. It plays into this circus, this continual demonizing and criminalizing of the other, and looking at that, looking at the world through that lens. And I think our job as alternative media is to take an alternative view and to show what are the real conditions, who are the real people. And over the last year, there's been some great reporting on KBOO, on Tanya Gomez Daza's show on Buscando America, where she went to the caravan. She went down to the so-called caravan and spoke to people and interviewed them, and also just went to Chiapas, Mexico, for the Women's Encuentro. And so if you are a Spanish speaker or an aspiring Spanish speaker, definitely look on the archives on the KBOO website under Buscando America, and you'll find some amazing interviews in Spanish of people, the people who are the actual ones impacted by U.S. policy in Central America.
And wow. Jenka, do you have thoughts, you know, for our listeners going into 2020, how can they be better media consumers? How is it best to digest and kind of think about these issues?
Think critically. Whatever you take in, look for other sources and always go to the source of the information. 80% of what's online is reposts. And so if you see something and instead of just sharing it immediately, look at it, go into it, see what the source is, find other sources. I know that our current social media landscape has led people to have shorter and shorter attention spans, but actually take the time to do a little bit of research about whatever you're reading before you just share it. Even if it's something that you think, well, I agree with this news story, you should look into it a little more. I've seen so many posts from people that should know better posting things that are not necessarily true or things that are old and they just are repeated. So definitely look into whatever you can. Go to Project Censored. They have a great website, projectcensored.org. CommonDreams.org does daily updates and reports from nonprofits. And another great website is The Intercept and The Gray Zone. So check those out and always tune in to KBOO to find out what's
going
on.
We'll bring it to you, yes. And if you are listening and you are like, what, I have to be part of this, we are going to have a volunteer orientation February 4th from 6 to 8. That's February 4th. I think that's a Tuesday, starting at 6 p.m. until 8. And thank you so much for tuning in. Again, my name is Tammy. I am the Public Affairs Director.
I'm Althea. I'm the News Director.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg, the Web and New Media Coordinator.
Yeah, and remember that if you missed any of our programming yesterday, you can check it out at kboo.fm/hindsight2020.
And remember, who, what, when, where, why.
Critical thinking.
The Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center wouldn't exist without the local folks who volunteer their time to help the homeless. In episode 4 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast, we meet Tiana, Pete, and John to learn what they do, why they volunteer, and what they have learned about the homeless and themselves as a result. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Dost movie screening on Saturday, February 1st at 3:30 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Dost is a documentary about a young lady who uses psychedelic therapy to overcome her addiction to heroin. After the show, there will be a panel discussion featuring members of the cast and production. They will be taking questions from the audience. Again, that's the Dost movie screening on Saturday, February 1st at 3:30 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the Magical Music Petting Zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studio.